You are listening to The News Project, in studio. Brought to you by GNAT TV.
Hello and welcome back to another edition of GNAT TV's In-Depth series. I'm Andrew McKeever, the news director at GNAT TV's News Project, and it's a pleasure to have you with us today on Wednesday, April 20th. It's also a great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Lewis Myers, who's a hospital physician at Rutland Regional Medical Center, and he's running for Congress on the Democratic in the Democratic primary. He's joining four other candidates already in the race, Lieutenant Governor Molly Gray, Senators Becca Ballant and Keisha Ram Hinsdale, and CNA Chase Clifford. Dr. Myers just announced recently, about 2 weeks ago, and is throwing his hat in the ring for that opportunity to run for Congress to replace Peter Welch, who's hoping to move on to the U.S. Senate following the retirement of Senator Patrick Leahy. So, Dr. Myers, a great pleasure to have you with us. Thank you for making the time for this conversation today.
Thank you, Ed, and it's really an honor to be here.
Well, it's great to have you here. And so I guess the first and obvious question is, what prompted your candidacy? What made you decide that this was a year to throw your hat in the ring in a race that was already, I guess you could say, crowded?
Well, this is, I think all of us know, this is a time of great turmoil for our country, for the world. This is going to be a critical election. It is an open seat, which means that there will be more voices coming into the election. And I felt strongly about our country and about where our country can serve and where I would like to serve. And I think that when I looked and listened to the people that were already in the campaign, it did seem like there was a certain similarity in what all of them were saying. And I felt like it was important to have a diversity of voices in the campaign. And I'm a moderate Democrat. I think that all four of the other candidates tend to be more in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And I think we can, it would be helpful to have a debate and to talk about some of these issues and the way the Democratic Party is and where Vermont is, because I think that there are a lot of moderates in Vermont, which is what I'm finding, both on moderate Republican and moderate Democrats. And I think they've been hoping to hear some solutions or ideas that are not on either of the extremes.
Okay. Well, let's unpack a few of those issues then. I'm assuming that as a doctor, as a physician, healthcare must be a fairly important subject for you. And I guess I just wondered, if you were elected to Congress, what would be some of the things you'd like to see change in the way that the United States does its healthcare? For instance, would you be a fan of Medicare for All, for instance, which has been one idea that's been proposed from time to time to kind of fix some of the issues in how we deliver healthcare in this country and how people pay for it?
Well, you are right that healthcare is a great concern of mine. I've been a physician for this spring. It'll be 29 years, not counting the 4 years of medical school before that. So much of that time is, first 15 years were in primary care, and which I loved. And then this last 9 years has been as a hospital physician at Rutland Regional Medical Center. And I've also found that very satisfying. It is a wonderful hospital. I think Vermont is absolutely fortunate to have it here. It's serving a great purpose and need, not only for the general Rutland community, but I think for the state as a whole. It's an example of what a really good independent hospital can do. I have watched and seen a lot of changes in healthcare in the last 30 years, and some of them are good in terms of what we can do medically now to help people in terms of diagnosis, in terms of treatment, in terms of prevention. But unfortunately, in terms of the healthcare system in general, I think we've actually deteriorated over the last 30 years. And there are a number of reasons for that. And we're not going to be able to fix it all in one fell swoop, as it were, with one act. And we can talk a little bit about this. I think actually one of the biggest problems in healthcare, if I had to name one problem, is the idea that bigger is better. which started about 30 years ago, in the sense that these large integrated healthcare systems, whether they be for-profit or not-for-profit, such as the University of Vermont, as they began to, that the bigger they got, the better that they would get, the less expensive they would get, the better healthcare they could deliver, the more efficient they would be. And in fact, we haven't seen that. And if anything, we've seen the opposite, that in many cases, independent hospitals, when they're well-run, like Rutland Regional, can do an outstanding job at less cost and a better sense of sort of community involvement. Same holds true for medical practices. As I'm sure listeners know, many of the medical practices in parts of Vermont, whether it's southern Vermont with Dartmouth or northern central Vermont with University of Vermont, have been bought up and are now UVM or Dartmouth practices. And it brings some advantages, but I think it has also added greatly to the cost. Because what happens is when practices or hospitals get, when hospital systems get so large, they gain monopoly power and they begin to charge higher prices. And we're seeing that, for example, at the University of Vermont, where their prices have far exceeded other hospitals per patient visit. And now the insurance companies are sort of pushing back and it's become sort of a battle royale. But so I think that is one issue of bigger is better. It doesn't always hold. We know that there are disparities in the way where we deliver healthcare and how we deliver healthcare. Racial disparities, income disparities. And I think that we're only beginning to sort of quantify that. And we need to, once we know it's there, we need to figure out how to give care more equitably. The Medicare for All, which of course Senator Sanders and others have supported, I would not, first of all, I don't think it has a prayer passing any time in the near future, whether even if the Democrats manage to hold on to the House and or Senate. I think that there's just simply not enough support for that. I would support lowering the initial age of a Medicare application to 60 from the current 65. And that is a policy that could gain some traction. People at 60 to 65 begin to have some increased health needs simply due to aging and other factors. And unfortunately, because we still have ageism in our country, a lot of people at that age either would like to retire early or are being pushed out of their jobs in one form or another. And when that happens, they're left with at least 5 years or more of having to pay for very expensive private insurance, unless they qualify for in one of the states for the expanded insurance through with the Affordable Care Act. So I think that lowering it to the age to 60 would give people in that age group a feeling of security that they can either retire early and not have to worry as much about their health insurance, or they can change jobs and take a new direction even at age 60. And many people would like to try something new, but they're afraid to leave their jobs because of the health insurance issue. So I think it would be a terrific thing. I think in return, we should expect that the insurance companies would lower some of their premiums because they will now not necessarily have to be covering people who are at more risk for having health problems.
Okay, I guess the logical follow-up to that question is one about how do you feel the country has done in terms of handling the COVID-19 pandemic?
It's been very difficult. For one thing, there was so much unknown about this virus and the variants that were occurring. So I have empathy or some understanding that it has been difficult to get a consistent message out. And I think that certainly concerns people. Obviously, it got the whole issue of vaccines and masks got sort of conflagrated with some of the other social and political issues of our day in various parts of the country. And to the extent that has and did cost lives, it's tragic. I've seen at least two or three people at Rutland perish from COVID who probably didn't need to, had they been vaccinated or perhaps taken some of the other precautions that you mentioned. And it's just so tragic. Any preventable death, of course, is always tragic and particularly sad. So I think the virus itself has been, I call it a wily little devil, because it just has shown a remarkable ability to mutate and produce these variants. And so we do see lulls in the infection rate, and then it comes back again as it is now. So it's hard to produce a consistent message. And I understand that some of the collateral damage from school closings and from business closings and others has been very real, and we're just beginning to see the effect, the results of that in terms of lower academic scores among students, of closed businesses, mental health problems, increased crime in the cities, perhaps related. So it's not an easy answer. I will tell you one fascinating place where the result has been somewhat different, and it's interesting. That is Portugal. Portugal initially had one of the highest mortality rates from COVID early on in the world. And then they assigned to lead the COVID fight, a battle, as it were, the Navy Admiral, active duty Navy Admiral, who was a submarine commander, kind of looked the part. If you had to cast a Navy commander in a movie, he would have been it. They took it out of the political realm. They made him sort of the director of the COVID. He always appeared in uniform, by the way, military uniform. He framed it as a battle that all of the Portugal was in against this enemy, and he called on sort of the patriotism of the Portuguese. And they responded remarkably. I think they've got a vaccination rate like in the 90s, well up in the 90s as a country. And their mortality rates then became one of the lowest in Europe. So it's hard to say it's just due to that one man or that decision, but I'm betting that had an influence. And I think that had we perhaps taken some of the directions out of the White House and out of the political realm and assigned it somehow to someone who would have sort of general respect in the country, it might have made a difference. It's hard to know. But this is going to be with us for a while, and we're going to continue to find better treatments and just hope everyone stays as safe as they can.
Well, boy, this is a subject we could probably talk about for quite a while, but let me move on to a few other issues that might be coming up during the course of the campaign and, well, between now and the primary in August. Child care, paid family leave, affordable housing, three big issues there. I guess I'll just ask you to briefly comment on what your stance is on in those three areas.
On some of these issues, you know, it's some of these will be state issues and some will be federal, and others a combination of them. The child care issue is a tremendous problem. It was before COVID. It will continue to be. And not just child care, I might mention elder care, because I have a special interest in helping older Vermonters and helping older citizens stay in their homes when they wish to. And I saw a statistic recently that up to 6.6 million people who are not currently in the workforce but could be are the reason is because they are at home taking care of either children or older or ill relatives. That's a huge number. So the child care, I mean, clearly it is underpaid workforce, and that we need to find a way to, and I think the Biden administration is, and Congress will allocate more money toward child care. I think one of the issues there, though, and just raise this, is that it is a tough job. And it will be interesting to see how high money the salary has to be boosted in order to get and retain regular child care. Anyone who's done child care for particularly as a job, not to mention their own children, but as a job for other people's children, know that it's a very tough job, requires a lot of concentration and effort, it's exhausting. And simply throwing money at the problem may or may not solve it all. Obviously, it will help. The other thing I would mention in that is that we have during the Trump administration, sharply decreased immigration. And in some communities, the immigrants actually were ready and willing to serve in childcare capacities and often did a wonderful job. They came from countries where children were really valued and treasured. And big extended families were the communities were the norm, so everyone took care of everyone's children. So, you know, I think that we need to look at it both ways, both increasing the pay and hopefully using the immigration system to bring in people who are ready and willing to work at these sometimes challenging jobs. Family leave, I think we are behind the rest of the world, or rest of Europe for sure on that. And I think that, again, I think the Biden administration is looking at extending, and Congress extending some form of family leave where there's no question that it helps new families after the birth of a child or helps ill relatives manage to stay out of the hospital and out of nursing homes when that care can be provided. So it's just the decent, good thing to do. I think you have to find that, and we struggled with that in Vermont in, over the last 5 to 10 years, find that sweet spot, if you will, between providing family leave but not making it tremendously onerous and expensive and at times backbreaking for a small businesses. So I think that's one of the challenges. Childcare, family leave, and what was the third one?
Of housing, affordable housing, workforce housing.
Oh, my goodness.
How can we simulate more housing development?
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, it's
a big subject, and we could just spend the entire program talking about that one, I'm sure.
Yeah, and I think you mentioned that it's everywhere in the country, which is really a remarkable fact, because I think that you used to be able to go to outlying communities, rural communities, underpopulated areas, and find affordable housing if you wanted. And but even that's not the case anymore. There has been some migration from the cities or people fleeing COVID and now who can work remotely. It's hard for me to believe that is the only or the major reason why housing has gotten so expensive, although we have seen some of that even here in Vermont. I know it's been a case in Rutland. I think it really has to do with low inventory and talking to various real estate agents. You know, there's just not much inventory out there. So we need to, are we going to put together a national program to build housing? It would be a big step, but it may be the step that's needed. Otherwise, we end up leaving it to the marketplace. Probably the more feasible solution would be some sort of public-private agreement where the government helps subsidize putting up sort of standard lower cost housing in various communities, targeting the communities that really need it and where it's needed. Big job for the Secretary of HUD for sure. It's holding the whole society back at this point. Young people can't get started. People are afraid to move because they're afraid they won't be able to find anything else in their price range once they do move. So it's holding everyone back.
In connection with that, find out what you thought about a question that seems to have bubbled up again recently, whether or not student loan debt interest should be canceled more or less permanently.
No, I'll say a simple no on that. But within that no, there are some other thoughts. The reason I would say no is because it, for one thing, it would be tremendously expensive for the federal government to simply cancel all loans. There are billions of dollars, billions and billions, millions of dollars out there. It is an obligation people took on. Whether it was a fair obligation is debatable, but it is an obligation. So I think, and there are people who have paid off their loans in the past who would probably feel somewhat aggrieved. That doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't help in every way we reasonably can. First of all, I think it's very clear that there have been predatory for-profit, I'll put in air quotes, colleges or universities out there who have really preyed on people. There was an article, I believe, in the New York Times recently that, in particular, women of color, black Black women who have put a high premium on getting an education and advanced degrees. They have targeted these people. They will sometimes bring them in sort of a bait and switch. They will give them, you know, get them going and get everything seems to be going well. And then these women will get to toward the end of their tenure, at end of their college program or PhD program, and all of a sudden the university will find ways to delay them while they're still charging tuition. So sometimes the tuitions end up doubling essentially from what they were told in the beginning. These are the kind of things that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is going to look at, particularly under this administration. And they should. These places should be closed down, these predatory places. They're not really providing the education. They're just cash machines. In terms of the colleges, you know, I think about this. I went to college a long time ago, but even at a private school, the tuition was so low, even adjusted for inflation, that very few students came out in debt. Even students who were whose parents were not wealthy. I mean, you could work, take a part-time job on campus, and actually pay your tuition, which is unheard of at this point. The tuition at my college has now gone up by 1,000% since in the last 30-some, 40 years. So, whereas inflation obviously has only gone up a tiny fraction, you know, a small fraction of that. So the question is, why did colleges get so expensive? Maybe we could ask the same about healthcare, but I'll stay on colleges right now. Because I think it's, we have to ask, are they, can they justify that kind of increase based on the education they're providing? And I think the answer is no. I think so much money at many of these colleges, public and private, went into huge football field houses and weight training, five-star dorms, Michelin-starred cafeterias, things that are not really needed to provide a good education. And I think that if the federal government is going to do some loan repayments for the students or waive off some of these loans, then the government, need to expect that the colleges are going to come under some cost containment. The other question was the one-year service. I suppose part of my I harken back to the Kennedy administration, the beginning of the Peace Corps, really, when President Kennedy called on young people and sometimes older people as well to serve their country and to serve. And there were many different ways to serve. Obviously, the military being one, but there was the Peace Corps. There's been AmeriCorps. There's been VISTA. So many ways that people can serve. And I think that right now, with millions and millions of jobs unfilled, with young people struggling to know where their path lies, looking at this kind of huge tuition and wondering whether it's worthwhile to take that on, I think doing a gap, and so many taking a gap year at this point, so many in college students now taking a gap year, using that gap year in a more formalized way to serve the country in some way, civilian, and I'm talking now about the civilian sector in particular, in return for 2 years of paid tuition. That would be one way to reduce college costs for everyone and without necessarily wiping off the debt for, you know, both retroactively and proactively. And I think it would give a better sense of service to the country, but also allowing people to be in situations where they might mix with people who they might not otherwise meet, because we have become sort of a culturally segregated society. People are rarely with other people who either disagree with them politically or of a different race or background. So this would give a chance to hopefully bring people a little bit more together, more understanding.
What are some of your thoughts on how we can make a transition to a more renewable energy-based economy without massively disrupting people's livelihoods and business activity?
Well, I think that it gets back to what I said at the beginning of this half hour, and that, again, I want to state that I'm a moderate Democrat. And what I mean by that is it has something to do with life and professional experience and understanding how change tends to happen, substantial and lasting change. And it usually doesn't happen with a slogan, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens organically and over time, and usually often step by step. I think it is, if we want to look at the positive, I think that with the exception of a few less and less people these days, but most people, I think, understand that the climate is changing, whether they're farmers, whether they're urban dwellers, whether they're living on the coast and see their houses and businesses flooding away. I think most people understand that something is happening and that the numbers that we're seeing, the measurements that we're seeing are very real. So I think that's, I guess you'd have to say progress. It's unfortunate it's taken a long time, but it is happening. People at least accept this. Question is, what will we do about it? You know, on the one extreme, you have Greta Thunberg in Denmark saying that we should stop all fossil fuels in 5 years, be done with them. I think what we're seeing right now, where Russia, I think, only supplies 10% of the world's fuel, if I believe that's correct, that the enormous disruption that's causing. Our gas prices may be a little higher in many countries around the world and regions around the world. People are going to starve to death. This is going to produce massive famine because they can't afford the fuel to run their economies at all. So I think we have to find a way forward that will be acceptable to as many people as possible. And there are certainly things we can be doing now. I think that as the Biden administration is changing the regulations to increase the required fuel efficiency of cars and vehicles, I think that's a good step forward, because I think, and many of the auto companies are okay with this. They know how to do this. As long as there's consistency, they can do this. Putting money, obviously, into research and development of alternative fuels, such as solar and wind power, water power, electric vehicles, and maybe hydrogen vehicles is important. The one that gets talked about less in this country is nuclear power. And I think one of the tragedies in Germany, one of the unfortunate things, is that over a period after Fukushima meltdown in Japan, Germany and Angela Merkel decided that they were going to shut down all their nuclear reactors very quickly and deactivate them. And the result now is they are even more dependent on Russia than they were before. So I think if we want to maintain our own independence, we do have other resources such as wind, solar, and whatnot, but nuclear power is essentially a very clean form of energy. It does carry certain risks, as we know, but the new nuclear reactors are smaller. I'm not a nuclear scientist, but from what I've read, they are smaller and safer and produce even less waste than they did before. So I think we need to include that in the discussion. France, by the way, is moving very, and England are both moving rapidly in this direction with these smaller nuclear reactors. Germany, of course, is unfortunately not.
There's several other topics I'd love to have more time to talk about, just inflation and economic growth, public safety and law enforcement.
And I just want to stress that there is a choice for Vermonters in this election, and I felt that it's important and critical that there be a choice, and that's why I'm running. That for those who feel that they are more moderate and want to move forward, but in a way that makes sense, I'm going to work with them.
All right. Well, Dr. Lewis Meyer is a physician at the Rutland Regional Medical Center, running for Congress. Dr. Myers, thank you again for your time. And
thank you.
We'll look forward to seeing you again.
Thank you, Mr. McKibben.
All right. Thank you. And thanks to all of you for watching as well. Hope you found our show interesting, and we'll see you again next time. All right. Take care.
Thank you for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.